I've been studying various aspects of anti-de-Sitter space for almost 15 years, ever since the discovery of ABS-CFT. And I thought I had a good sort of quantitative understanding of how gravity behaves in this context. But I was wrong. A surprising new property of anti-de-Sitter gravity has been discovered recently, and that's what I want to tell you about. I should start off with an apology. I'm not going to say anything directly related to condensed matter in this talk, but I will say a little bit about the dual field theory interpretation of this instability that we find. The work was done with two postdocs, Oscar Diaz and George Santos. And I have to say that George did all the hard work on this project. And he's sitting right here in the audience. So if you have any hard questions, address them to George. There was also an important earlier paper by Bison, and I won't try to pronounce his collaborator. but I'll talk about that as well. OK, let me just start off with a couple of elementary comments about anti-de-Sitter space. As you know, this is the maximally symmetric solution to a theory of gravity coupled to a negative cosmological constant. I'm going to set the radius of curvature of ADS equal to 1. And this is, in fact, the theory that I'm going to be talking about most of the time. I'm not going to need any of the fancy matter fields of supergravity or string theory. This will be a property of pure gravity with negative cosmological constant. The ADS metric is given as shown here. These are what's called global coordinates because they cover the entire space-time. And they're written in this form, which makes the sort of spherical symmetry and the time invariance manifest. There are Poincaré coordinates that some of you may be more familiar with, in which this Minkowski metric shows explicitly. The Poincaré coordinates don't cover the entire space-time, and the effect I want to talk about doesn't happen in this particular patch of anti-de-Sitter space. It happens only if you think about anti-de-Sitter globally. So I'll be working with these global coordinates. So as you know, conformally, anti-de-Sitter looks like the interior of a cylinder. You can easily see that by just taking this metric, multiplying by 1 over r squared. Then at large radius, the metric is just the product of time and an ordinary two-sphere. So that's the boundary, and then the space fills out inside. And with energy-conserving boundary conditions, waves bounce off infinity and return in finite time. The dual field theory lives on the product of a two-sphere and time. OK, at the linearized level, anti-de-Sitter appears just as stable as Minkowski space or de-Sitter. The perturbations, if they start small, they stay small. They just oscillate. Everything looks fine. But for Minkowski or de-Sitter, it's been shown that small finite perturbations, non-infinitesimal, but actual finite perturbations remain small. And this has never been shown for anti-de-Sitter space. So you might ask, why not? Well, the answer is, it's just not true. So here's the claim. Anti-de-Sitter is non-linearly unstable. Generic small but finite perturbations will eventually become large and form black holes. The energy cascades from low frequency to high frequency modes in a manner reminiscent of the onset of turbulence. And that's why we call this a turbulent instability.
Gary, a stupid question.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you could obviously form black holes in Minkowski space too, but they wouldn't change the asymptotics of the space. So what do you mean by how is this different from Minkowski?
It doesn't happen in Minkowski. In order to form, if you take a small finite perturbation of Minkowski space, it doesn't form black holes. The waves just disperse.
Oh, I see. Okay, they disperse
together. To form black holes, you have to have sort of enough energy. You have to have it concentrated in the right way.
Apparently, you just have to keep trying.
Yeah. So here's maybe your first reaction to a statement like this. Doesn't this contradict the fact that anti-de-Sitter is supersymmetric? After all, we're used to hearing that supersymmetric solutions are stable. Yeah?
Actually, just one preliminary question. So this is a classical statement or?
Classical.
Okay.
Yeah. Most of the talk will just be classical properties of gravity. I will discuss toward the end what happens in string theory and when the quantum effects are included.
Do you ever consider spherical symmetric solutions?
No. There are no spherical solutions in this theory of pure gravity except for the black holes. The boundary theory lives on a sphere, but I'm going to be including all the spherical harmonic excitations.
Okay.
Yeah, not spherical symmetry.
So your perturbation is also supersymmetric or no?
No. Okay. But okay. So I mean the answer to this is going to be sort of obvious to some of you. But there is a statement that anti de Sitter is supersymmetric. Supersymmetric solution is supposed to be stable. Even without supersymmetry, there is a statement that anti de Sitter space has a positive energy theorem. And one often hears a statement that if you have a positive energy theorem, then you have nonlinear stability. I've even said things like that on various occasions. And so the short answer to whether this contradicts any of these famous statements is no. It doesn't contradict anything. And the reason is the following. The positive energy theorem states the following. If the matter satisfies a reasonable energy condition, then the energy is greater than or equal to zero for all non-singular asymptotically anti de Sitter initial data from which you can evolve to get solutions. And the energy vanishes if and only if the space-time is anti de Sitter. And that's the statement of a positive energy theorem in general relativity. And this ensures that anti de Sitter cannot decay. There's no other zero energy solution for it to decay into. So you cannot have a potential like this, where you have anti de Sitter in some metastable state, and it's going to decay into something else. So that's just ruled out. That's the essence in which anti de Sitter itself is stable given a positive energy theorem. But that does not ensure that a small amount of energy added to ADS won't generically get big and form black holes. That statement is usually ruled out by arguing that waves disperse at late times. And that's what happens in Minkowski space, the waves disperse. So a good way to see the difference between these two notions of stability is an example I learned from the Fermos at the University of Cambridge. So consider gravity coupled to just a massless scalar field. This is a nice simple theory. It has a positive energy theorem, and it's known that small nonlinear perturbations of Minkowski space remain small. Now change the sign in front of the scalar action. Okay, now the scalar field has negative energy, and there is no positive energy theorem. There are solutions with arbitrarily negative energy. Nevertheless, it remains true that Minkowski space is nonlinearly stable. Small finite perturbations remain small simply because the waves disperse in this theory just as they did before. Okay. Now, here's an example of a theory which doesn't have a positive energy theorem but is still nonlinearly stable. ADS, I'm going to argue, is an example going the other way. It has a positive energy theorem but is nevertheless unstable.
But it's just you have a box, you create some kind of waves,
they focus. Yeah, it's because you don't have this fact that the waves keep disperse at late times. It's the fact that it's in a box.
You could put Minkowski's space in a box.
Well, you actually, if you take Minkowski's space and you make a periodic identification to make it a torus, then it is unstable.
Yeah.
It's known to be unstable.
Sure.
Not well. What's known in that case is that there's a singularity theorem. You actually have a proof that generic solutions are singular. Well, in some cases, the whole space collapses to like a Big Crunch singularity. Okay.
So, yeah. In what sense is Minkowski space? Well, it's proven to be. Is the full nonlinear hole?
Yes.
Because you could imagine that you could have a black hole that's growing and radiating off negative energy, so you could, you know, have a balance that conserves energy with the wrong sign.
So this is a classical statement.
This is a classical statement. Okay, so we're not.
Negative energy.
What?
How are you radiating?
Well, you have a scalar that has negative energy.
Negative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
this is proven.
You can't use that.
It's
proven that it's nonlinearly stable for sufficiently small perturbations.
If you can ever make a black hole in the story,
you always need a norm. That's rather difficult.
Right, so there's a particular norm on the space of initial data, and the proof is that if that norm is less than a certain amount, a finite amount, if it's small enough, then you get global existence of solutions, no singularities, no black holes, that everything just radiates nicely to infinity. That was proved in Minkowski space in a famous paper by Christodoulou and Kleinerman. It was like 500 pages long when they finished it. It was not an easy proof. Yes.
So you're saying this is unstable on a sphere, but not in the Poincaré patch, or not the field theory in
right.
flat space.
Right.
Intuitively, when you're on a sphere, the field theory is almost gapped. I mean, there's a gap to the KK scale of the sphere. So it seems like there would be less small perturbations that could be dangerous if you have a gapped spectrum.
But you have a long time to wait. I mean, in a sense, because the Poincaré patch covers such a small part of ADS, you don't have time for this instability to set in.
I see.
Stuff
just doesn't get back into the Poincaré patch when it bounces.
Yeah, or they go into some other Poincaré patch. Right? Anti de Sitter is actually an infinite number of copies of this Poincaré patch. So they just go from one Poincaré patch to the next. You don't see it within one Poincaré patch. Okay, before I get into the calculation a little bit, let me just give you some general arguments for why this is true, and some of them have already been mentioned. So one is just the statement that anti de Sitter boundary conditions act like a confining box. So any finite excitation which is added to this box might be expected to eventually explore all the configurations consistent with the conserved quantities, including small black holes. So that's sort of an ergodicity argument, which suggests that finite perturbations of ADS should eventually form black holes. Another general argument is the singularity theorem I just mentioned. So there's a singularity theorem proven by Hawking and Penrose back in 69, which says that closed universes are generically singular. And so that would take care of the case of actually putting, identifying Minkowski space into a torus. Now, anti de Sitter acts like a closed universe for the fields inside because it's like this confining box. So one would expect it to be generically singular. I mean, as physicists, we're used to thinking that, whatever happens at linearized level is probably going to be true for small, finite things. That's sort of often the case. But this is a dramatic example where that's just not the case.
Which energy condition are you assuming here?
Okay, so here you need the strong energy condition.
So my next question is, what happens if you just have null?
Let's see.
Doesn't work.
Null energy condition is not enough for this. Well, sure. Okay, good. But a negative Coswander constant satisfies the strong energy condition.
But if you added matter, you might actually change the conclusion then.
Sure.
I mean, reasonable matter.
Sure. Yeah.
So I should say that while I'm happy with that paragraph as a motivation, one should again emphasize that it's not obvious that ADS acts like a closed universe in quite this sense, because as you said, in the case of identifying Minkowski space or a universe on a sphere, many universes become singular by going to a Big Bang or a Big Crunch, and that's clearly not going to happen in ADS because of the boundary conditions.
Right. No. Right. Well, it's certainly true that the theorems as stated don't apply to anti de Sitter. They require a compact space-like surface, and we don't have that. But it's motivation. Okay. Now you notice I keep talking about generic. I've been saying generic perturbations form, become large, and the reason is that there are solutions which don't become large, which don't have this instability, and in fact there are a lot of them. Okay. So it turns out that for each linearized gravitational mode, each graviton in anti de Sitter has a corresponding exact nonlinear solution, which does not become singular and does not form black holes. And these solutions we call gions because, well, Wheeler coined the name gion for any, gravitational, a lump of gravitational energy which is held together by its own self-gravity.
Well, it had to be topologically stable.
No, it didn't have anything to do with topology. He didn't require a non-trivial topology. Of course, we're cheating a little bit here because we're using the sort of negative cosmological constant to help confine our gravitation. But that's still gravity.
Are there examples where you don't have that confinement? I mean, in Minkowski space, are there real geons?
No, there are no real geons. You can get stuff to stay together for a while, but in Minkowski space, they all disperse.
So you have an explicit solution or just an existence one?
Well, I'll show you what we have. We have a perturbative construction of them.
Which is convergent?
No, we haven't shown it convergent. this is evidence for.
But they're geons in the sense that if you scatter them, do they preserve their identity?
No, if you scatter them, they produce singularities because of the instability of ADS.
Always.
Yes. Huh? Yeah. Well, probably. I mean, everything I should... Look, I'm going to be giving a talk to a bunch of mathematicians in a little while, and for mathematicians, this is all just evidence, right? Everything I'm going to say today is evidence for these claims, so it's not... We don't have proofs.
No, but we have a proof of instability.
A proof of instability.
Because all you need is one...
Unstable mode.
Okay.
But for each graviton, you have a corresponding exact solution, which does not grow, it stays small. They are, as I said, they're non-singular, globally asymptotically ADS, there are an infinite number of them, but they're all special. And they're special because they're exactly periodic in time, and they're in fact invariant under a continuous symmetry. But this is not sort of an ordinary stationary solution. The solutions are invariant only under one symmetry, which is a combination of a time translation and a rotation. So it's sort of like a rigidly rotating, non-axisymmetric body. So here's an intuitive picture of the instability. Geons are, in some sense, analogous to gravitational plane waves. So gravitational, well, there's linearized plane waves, of course, but in general relativity, we have exact solutions which are directly analogous to a plane wave. Now, Penrose showed that if you collide exact plane waves, you always produce singularities. And the reason is that one sort of plane wave focuses the other, and they end up concentrating, and you produce singularities in finite time. Trying to superpose geons, so if you put two geons in ADS, then they're going to sort of, in some sense, keep colliding because they keep bouncing off the ADS boundary condition. And because of the mutual focusing, you might expect them to again produce singularities at late time.
When you say plane wave, you mean with the full symmetry of the plane, not just plane front end, I guess?
Yes. So I guess the case that's been studied is the sort of exact plane waves, not the plane fronted waves.
Because they typically don't form singularities, for example, the ones that are just plane front.
Well, the plane fronted waves often have singularities. I mean, the Eichelberg-Sechsel metric is singular by itself, right?
Yeah, and you can
put a point particle there. Okay, there's a singularity.
Yeah, two of those scatter and they don't generically form a singularity. Right?
Well, that's because the curvature falls off away from it. But okay, so if you ignore the singularities that you put in, you don't form new ones. That's true. Okay, so that's the intuitive picture, and are there any sort of further questions before I get into a little bit of the calculation which justifies this?
So these geons are localized in some sense?
They are certainly localized to about the ADS radius. They're sort of sitting in ADS. That's right.
But they're as large as ADS.
They're about as large as ADS, right.
Are they the things that are bouncing off the wall? Is that how we
should
think about them?
Well, I don't like thinking about them bouncing off the wall because there's this sort of helical killing field, right? So they're all invariant under this sort of continuous symmetry. So they're just like a rotating non-axisymmetric body.
In quantum field theory, is there a similar statement about the existence of sort of solitonic solutions with this kind of property? A generic statement about strongly coupled theories.
Yeah. We'll come to this. We'll come to the dual CFT. We'll come there.
Does the mutual focusing come out of a detailed calculation, or is there intuitive understanding?
This is the intuitive picture for the calculation I'm about to describe.
Right, but how do you know it's mutual focusing and not mutual defocusing? Is that a generic property of gravity?
Or? Well, gravity tends to focus.
Yeah, so it's a generic property.
That's just a generic statement.
So for that statement, you don't need a detailed calculation? Or you...
Probably, but you may not have thought that, you know, you may wonder whether there's enough focusing to produce singularities and things like that.
Sorry, I had a similar question. I mean, if you just took massive particles and bounced them off the walls, and they would have many opportunities to try and form black holes. But are you saying that's not enough, that you need this particular kind of solution to show instability?
Well, the instability is generic, so it's going to happen, you know, all the time. And this is...
It doesn't have massive particles, it just has...
It's graviton. It's graviton. There's massless graviton. It's generic. So this is, well, this intuitive picture might become a little clearer when I show you a little bit of the calculation. Okay, so here's just an outline of the calculation. We want to construct these solutions perturbatively. Okay, so we expand the metric in a background metric, which is, of course, ADS, and then a series of higher order corrections. At each order, the correction has to solve this second order equation. The source on the right comes from all the lower order terms and their derivatives. This derivative operator, which is related to the Lichnerowitz operator, is just some complicated second order operator acting on a metric perturbation involving the curvature of the background ADS and the derivative operator of ADS and things like that.
Is that just a power series in epsilon?
Yes. Yes, this is just a power series in epsilon. That's all we're doing. Mm-hmm. Simple, straightforward approach. Now, there are different ways of, different types of perturbations. It's convenient to break them up in this way. There are what's called scalar-type perturbations, and those are perturbations in which the H is constructed from spherical harmonics. Okay, so you take advantage of the fact that the background is spherically symmetric. The TR components of H are really scalars as viewed from the two-sphere. So they are just proportional to ordinary spherical harmonics. The sort of T theta and R theta terms are like vectors. So they become gradients, derivatives of the spherical harmonics. And the theta theta terms are like two derivatives of the spherical harmonics or the metric spherical harmonic. There are also vector type perturbations. And those can be constructed from vector harmonics. On a two-sphere, those are also related to the ordinary spherical harmonics. So they're just the dual of the gradient of Y. Now, in general, in higher dimensions, there are tensor-type perturbations, which are directly related to harmonic, you know, tensors. But on a two-sphere, there are no harmonic tensors, so we don't need to worry about that. So we just need to worry about these two types of perturbations. And then, of course, for each type, you have, you know, the spherical harmonic that you're constructing it from. Now, at each order, so at each order in perturbation theory, and for each spherical harmonic that you're constructing the perturbation from, you can reduce the entire metric perturbation to two functions, just two scalars, satisfying a two-dimensional wave equation. And this was first shown by Kodama and Ishibashi in 2003. So these phis are gauge invariant variables constructed from the metric perturbation. The T tilde, the source on the right, is a scalar constructed from the components of the source we had on the previous slide. There's some potential term. And then there's this two-dimensional wave operator, which is just the wave operator associated with the TR part of the ADS metric. Okay, so we can work with just these scalar equations.
Why
did you put
an 8 there?
An 8.
Was it a G?
Where is that?
The subscript on the box.
Oh, it's an S. This is a scalar. This is. I guess I can take it. I don't know.
So you're looking for. Okay.
What are the boundary conditions for these functions? One more thing. I say that there are two functions. One of these characterizes the scalar perturbations, and another one characterizes the vector perturbations. Okay, the boundary condition. Regularity at the origin requires that the scalar fall off like R to the L. That's sort of familiar. Asymptotically, the solutions go to something independent of R. These can be determined. These have arbitrary time dependence in general. And then there's a 1 over R correction and higher order corrections. Now, the boundary condition we want to impose is that the metric is fixed on the boundary. We don't want to be distorting the two-sphere, the cylinder. We want the perturbation H to fall off. And so you might have thought the right boundary condition for these engaged invariant variables phi is that R should vanish. But in fact, that's not the case. To keep the metric fixed at infinity, it turns out that you have to set S to 0. So that's rather counterintuitive, but if you trace through the relation between these, that's what you get. Unfortunately, there are some papers in the literature which sort of took the intuitive choice and computed the wrong thing.
So phi is, you said, engaged invariant
combination of the metrics. Yes.
But can you give us some intuitive sense of what it is?
It's basically you take the metric, the perturbation H, its components, and you take some derivatives of them and some combinations of them, and you construct these gauge invariant.
That's linear in H of each one, each order.
Yes, it's linear. And you can construct H from phi. So there are some explicit formulas which let you get back the metric perturbation in a particular gauge given the information phi. Okay, so let's now do it. At first order, well, this is just the linearized graviton. So you get the usual answer. The frequencies are quantized. They turn out to be 1 plus L plus 2P, where P is just the radial excitation. And the lowest mode with no radial excitation for the scalar perturbation has a rather simple form. Phi just, it goes like this. And you can see that for large R, this indeed goes to a constant. So it satisfies our boundary condition. A is just a normalization constant at this point. At small r, this falls off fast enough to be regular at the origin.
So again, I guess, to go back to that previous, so the norm, the sort of energy norm of metric perturbations doesn't become the Schrodinger norm of this.
No. Okay, so now here's the general structure of the calculation. We're going to have to solve this equation with a source. And if the source has a harmonic time dependence, like cosine omega t, then the solution will have the same harmonic time dependence in general, except when omega happens to agree with one of these normal mode frequencies that we have in the background, or the linearized order. Then you get a resonance, and the general solution involves a term which grows linearly in time. So this is just like forcing a harmonic oscillator at the resonant frequency, and you get these growing modes. Okay, and that's the source of the instability. So let's look at a couple of examples. Let's start with a single mode, an L equals 2, M equals 2 mode of the graviton. So you start doing the calculation, and you do the second order correction, and you find no resonances. So this is fine. You can compute the second order correction to your perturbation, and everything stays small. It oscillates and doesn't grow. You then go to third order, and you find one resonant term. But it turns out that you can set the growing mode to 0 by changing the frequency slightly. So if you shift the frequency in this way, by a term proportional to epsilon squared, the growing mode, this L here, is killed, and you get a smooth solution which stays small. And so, we did the calculation just through third order, but continuing this way, you construct the geon. You can show that there are no resonances at any even order, and it looks likely from the structure of the equations that at every odd order, you'll have one resonant term, which can again be removed by a small shift in the frequency.
This shift in the frequency is not resumming the series, right?
No. This is at each order. It's basically a gravitational, back reaction effect. You start with a certain frequency, and then you start making it slightly nonlinear, and the frequency gets shifted. It's going down a little bit, so it's getting.
You can view these things as resumming a different series. You can allow the growing modes and allowed polynomial growth in P. Resumming that series is usually equivalent to finding these frequency shifts.
this, you can take a series that grows in time and resum it and get something which doesn't grow in time?
Yeah, but all
because the growing was due to some perturbation about some wrong frequency.
Sine of omega t omega is
equal
to omega
plus
epsilon. Yeah, but it has to be absorbed in this way, so.
The fact that the frequency is shifted a little bit has an interesting consequence. It means that the symmetry of the exact solution is not the same as the symmetry of the original linearized solution. You might think that if you have a linearized solution with a certain symmetry and you sort of just, you know, make it big and nonlinear, that symmetry will be preserved. But that's not happening here. And you can see that because you start with, you know, some mode, the linearized level, which has some cosine omega t minus m phi dependence. That's clearly invariant under this symmetry, time translation plus omega over m times the rotation. This is the helical symmetry of the linearized solution. The higher order corrections have sources, which are just powers of this, basically. So you might think this symmetry should be preserved, except that we just saw that to remove the growing mode, we have to shift the frequency a little bit. So that changes the killing field, and the exact solution is invariant under slightly different symmetry. Okay, that was the geon. Now let's look at another example, a more generic one, where you start with a linear combination of two modes. Okay, so let's take our L equals 2, M equals 2 mode, and add to it an L equals 4, M equals 4 mode at the linearized level. Yes?
So this theory is just pure gravity.
Right.
If you add matter fields, would you expect that as the geon oscillated, it would dump its energy into the matter and so kind of disappear, or do you think there's still some solutions?
There's definitely solutions with matter as well. I mean, we've constructed some. It's easier because when you add scalar fields, you can, you know, actually construct solutions with less symmetry. I mean, you don't need, or you can keep back, you know, keep some symmetry. I'll talk a little bit about what happens with matter in a minute. Okay, so here's just a more general sort of starting point. Again, you start calculating the higher order corrections, and again, at second order, there's no problem. You have no resonances, so the second order perturbation stays small. There are more terms now, of course, so you're starting with a more general thing, and at third order, you find four resonant terms. Okay, the growing mode in two of them can be removed by adjusting the frequencies of your two original perturbations. Okay, so that gets rid of half of them.
In the same way?
Yeah, in just the same way. You shift them each a little
bit. By the same
amount? No, not by the same amount. By different amounts. You calculate what you need to get rid of the growing mode. And the growing mode of one of them just is absent. I mean, you luck out. You discover that if you impose your boundary conditions, that the growing mode just doesn't appear. So that leaves one. And the last growing mode just can't be removed. And it turns out that corresponds to an L equals 6, M equals 6 mode with omega equal to 7. So this is a mode that we didn't put in. It has higher frequency than any of the modes we started with. And it appears with a growing amplitude. Because that's the only way.
But it cannot be removed. You have to exhaust the base.
We have our second order differential equation. And we're imposing the boundary conditions that we need, regularity at infinity and at the origin. And the mode is, I mean, that growing piece of the mode has to be present to avoid singularities at the origin or at infinity. So we get this growing mode. Now, of course, energy is conserved under evolution. And as this mode ramps up its amplitude, the energy is going to be taken from the lower frequency modes that we started with. So this is the energy cascade to higher frequency modes, and we expect this to continue. When this mode gets bigger, it will, you know, then source higher frequency modes, which will have their own growing amplitudes, and this should continue.
So you would see this in higher orders of perturbation theory?
Right. At higher orders of perturbation theory, we would see the higher frequency modes turning on.
Just to understand, when you say can't be removed, you mean that it can't be removed by adjusting any of the parameters of your initial linearons on, so you can't shift frequencies, and you can't extract other linearized modes to cancel this.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean.
Because it's totally exhausted.
That's exactly what I mean. You try to shift the frequency as much as you can. You try to add other terms at lower order to see if you cancel. And there's
other lower terms are shifted frequencies.
Yeah.
And they,
Okay, so this is the, well, the evidence for this turbulent instability. Now, you might say, how do we know we get a black hole at late times? Well, we didn't evolve this general, you know, metric solution. That would be a full 3 plus 1 numerical relativity problem. But if you simplify the problem, you can do a lot more. So there was this very interesting paper by Bison and his collaborator earlier this year, which talked about spherically symmetric scalar field collapse in anti-de Sitter. So let me just remind you what happens with zero cosmological constant. This is a famous problem studied by Chaptuik and Christodoulou 20 years ago now. So what you find is that you take some initial spherically symmetric profile for your scalar field. There's some amplitude alpha and some arbitrary radial dependence f of r. And it's clear that when alpha is large, there's a lot of energy in your scalar field. This is an asymptotically flat space. There's a lot of energy, and you just collapse and you form a large black hole. It's also clear that when alpha is small, there's a very weak sort of perturbation of Minkowski space, and the waves just scatter and go off to infinity, and you never form a black hole. The solution is non-singular. But alpha is, of course, a continuous parameter, so you can ask what happens right on the threshold of forming a black hole. And it turns out there's a critical value, alpha star, which collapses to form what could be called a zero-mass black hole. It's a black hole of zero size, but that's really just a naked singularity. You form a singularity which is visible from infinity. Near this critical value, if you're just slightly above it, you form a very small black hole, and it was found that the mass of that black hole scales in an interesting way. It goes like this parameter alpha minus the critical value to an exponent gamma, where gamma, well, numerically is 0.37, but it's universal in the sense that it's independent of the initial profile of the scalar field. So this is like a critical exponent.
What is alpha star set by? I mean, alpha star, the...
What is it?
Yeah, I mean, what is it related to? What is it, I mean...
Well, it's... What is it related to? I mean, it's something you compute by asking, do you form a black hole or don't form a black hole? That's a binary. It's like a phase, you know, two different phases of the solution. It depends on the detailed shape of that. Right. Alpha star is not universal. The numerical value will depend on that. I mean, if f is of order 1, alpha star turns out to be order 1. And it's not that.
But gamma doesn't depend on f, right?
The gamma does not depend on f. That's the sense in which this is a universal behavior. Okay, so this is the critical collapse of scalar fields in asymptotically flat case. So now what happens in anti-de Sitter? Well, you get this. Okay, let me explain this because it's really quite interesting. On the bottom horizontal axis, we have alpha. This is an amplitude of the initial scalar field. And on the vertical axis, we have the radius of the initial black hole that you formed. So this is like the mass of the black hole that you form. I have to say initial because, of course, once you have a black hole, if you wait long enough, other stuff falls in and the black hole grows. But we're just interested in what happens when the sort of scalar field first comes down. And if you start with large values of the amplitude, what happens is that the scalar field immediately sort of forms a black hole. And so that's this curve. You form a black hole. As you decrease the amplitude, the size of that black hole that you form gets smaller and smaller, and you get a critical point, or alpha star here, alpha 1 I should call it, because there'll be more, alpha 1, where the mass of the black hole goes to 0, you get one of these critical solutions. And if you look right near this point, you find exactly this behavior. So it's behaving just like in asymptotically flat space. In asymptotically flat space, that would be the end of the story, but it's not the end in anti-de Sitter. You go a little bit below that, the scalar field comes in, passes through, nothing happens, goes off to infinity, comes back, and now forms a black hole. So this branch are black holes that are formed on the second try. Okay, it scattered through itself, went back off, and now forms a black hole. And you notice that these black holes exist for a while, but as you crank down the amplitude, eventually, these black holes get smaller and smaller, and you reach a second critical amplitude, which is sort of where you're just forming a naked singularity on the second pass. And once again, right near that point, you get exactly this behavior. for the scalar field again.
And gamma is the same, or gamma is here?
Gamma is exactly the same. It's exactly the same.
So the black holes you're forming are all small compared to the ADS radius?
Oh, yeah.
So that's okay.
Yeah, yeah, these are small.
I mean, they're going to zero.
Radius, I mean, yeah, these are really small because they're going to zero. Yeah.
Gary, even in the first branch, there'll be a bigger black hole formed than the second branch, right? It's not really discontinuous.
In the second pass, these small black holes do grow. That's right.
Right. So it's not, like, it's not as continuous as the graph.
Well, except that we're plotting the radius of the initial black hole.
Right, right.
When the black hole first forms, what is its size?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you can ask about the time. I mean, this doesn't show the time difference between, you know, these black holes and these black holes. But they, of course, see that when they do the numerical evolution, and it's exactly, well, it's roughly the sort of time for waves to bounce off. It's like pi or something in ADS units, the time for waves to bounce off infinity and come back.
So that's where the strength of gravity comes in, the time, right, the time scale. Pull it back. I mean, nothing on this plot depends on how big the Newton's constant is. Is this constant scaled out?
No, Newton's constant is there, multiplying the stress tensor.
So it must have to do with the time.
Well, it's
just
pure gravity. The only real scale left in the problem is the ADS.
No, this is coupled to
spare
scalars.
Oh, this is with the scalars.
These are spherically scalar fields.
It's in Minkowski, right?
Yeah. So actually, it's in...
Isn't this in alpha?
No,
alpha.
It reserved in the amplitude. Yeah, yeah, that's probably right. Yeah. Probably can be absorbed in alpha. Yeah. Okay, but you see the pattern here. So you make the black hole, you make the initial amplitude of your scalar field a little smaller than this, and now the scalar field scatters once, it goes off to infinity, it comes back, scatters perfectly fine a second time, and then on the third try, it forms a black hole. So here are the black holes on the third try, and you again lower the amplitude, and once again you get a critical point, which behaves exactly like all the others. And they follow this through about 10 cycles. So as you make the amplitude smaller and smaller and smaller, you know, the scalar fields just bounce back and forth, but eventually form black holes. Okay, so this is, you know, at least in the spherically symmetric case, strong evidence that you form black holes for arbitrarily small initial amplitudes. But they found something else.
What's the shape of this envelope?
This envelope here? I'm not sure they studied that.
Is this thing binding?
Yeah. They discovered something else, which I want to tell you about. So if you look at the curvature, just like the Ricci scalar at the origin, ask what is it doing? Well, if you start with a weak scalar, you know, field, the scalar field's oscillating, and so this Ricci scalar oscillates at the origin. But it oscillates with a period about 2, you know, or it's about the ADS, you know, light crossing time. And so that's a small number, and you can just average over that, or you look at the maximum Ricci scalar at the origin, and ask what it's doing. And now here's a plot over very long times. Okay, so the period is like 2, and here we have a plot which goes 200, 400, up to 1600 T. Very long time evolution. Starting with 4 different values of the scalar field, you know, small, smaller, even smaller, and smaller. Okay. And what's plotted here is, well, in their notation, this is the scalar curvature at the origin. Okay, so what you see is that the scalar, you know, curvature starts, you know, it doesn't change too much for a while, and then it takes off like crazy. This is a logarithmic scale, you see, in the curvature. And so the curvature at the origin starts growing exponentially. And then there's sort of like a little phase transition, and it starts growing even faster than exponential. And if you decrease your initial amplitude, so these are all small compared to what we had before, because you're not forming black holes with, you know, at long times, but the curvature is clearly growing. At even smaller amplitude, it just takes a little longer, and then you start having the same sort of behavior, a little longer, and you get the same thing.
So you see, there's no black hole forming anywhere on this plot?
No, I don't think they've seen black holes forming. I mean, they follow it, they're computing the scalar curvature at the origin, and they've not yet reached the black hole stage.
So this part would be, is the scale if you're going back and forth many times?
Yeah, yeah.
So it would be towards zero in your previous part.
Yeah, yeah. All the stuff before was like up to 10. Yeah, that was maybe up to 10.
The megasingularity will appear. This is naturally.
Yeah.
Will appear at the origin.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
These are driving
toward the naked singularity. Even without seeing the black hole, this is clearly an instability. Right, you put in very small perturbations, and then the curvature starts growing like crazy at late times.
Are the
EMFs
really reliable?
Yeah, yes, that's true.
Well, they are because of the following. You can check it. Well, I don't know what this would check. An interesting property which wouldn't hold if this was some numerical artifact, I think, is that there's a scaling relation. So here are four different values of the initial amplitude, and if you rescale time by the sort of amplitude squared, and you rescale the curvature by 1 over that that same parameter, the amplitude squared, all four curves more or less line up on top of each other. Okay. So I don't think they understand why this is happening.
Alpha.
Yeah, yeah, their epsilon is what I call alpha. I mean, epsilon is appropriate here because it's really small. Yeah?
Is this a violation of cosmic centership or not because you've chosen the spherical symmetry?
Well,
yeah, it's very specific. So in this sense, it's not generic, right?
It's not generic because it's spherically symmetric. Okay, normally, we say, the stuff was discovered 20 years ago, and people say cosmic censorship might hold in four dimensions. And the reason in asymptotically flat space is because there's one fine-tuning, right? You have to take alpha and fine-tune. Okay, so now you say in ADS, you don't need to fine-tune, it seems. You do need to fine-tune. I'm sorry, you don't get, in this case, you don't get naked singularities for all alpha. You have to fine-tune it. You have more choices, but there's still the discrete set.
Do the values get dense close to the origin?
They don't know, but I suspect yes. I suspect they probably do.
But in some sense, it is generic.
But it might be measured zero.
Yeah, it's not an open set. There's infinitely many, but it's not an open set.
Okay.
Yeah, so in this case, you might be forming black holes most of the time, and only for very special amplitudes you get right on the naked singularity.
Did they tune their amplitudes here to get as close to the zero mass black hole as possible, or are these just random small amplitudes?
I don't know exactly how they chose them. I mean, that was. Yeah.
In ADS, if you didn't choose a spherically symmetric configuration, you might still expect to form a black hole just because the stuff has nowhere to go. So is that known?
You mean for scalar fields?
Yeah.
Yes, I think that. Well, what we're saying this instability is that generically you do form black holes for almost anything you do, unless you tune set up carefully to get one of these gions or the scalar analog of a gion. That's certainly possible, and that was constructed first. I mean, that's been known for a while. Those are like boson stars, gravitationally bound scalar fields, so you can get boson stars. Okay, the conclusion of the scalar field is just what I've said. No matter how small you make the initial amplitude, the curvature at the origin just keeps growing, and eventually, you probably form small black holes, or maybe these naked singularities. Okay, so now what happens in string theory? So now let's leave general relativity for a moment and try to say something about the full string theory. So let's consider the 2D theory on ADS5 cross S5. I'll put back in the ADS5 now, so that's just scale L. You start off with two energy scales. There's a Planck energy and then a string energy. We're at weak coupling, so this string scale is less than the Planck scale. And now there are many more possible end states, okay, in string theory, because there's more things that can happen. And so if the initial energy is really big, if it's bigger than something like n squared over L, you form a five-dimensional black hole. These are black holes with radius bigger than the ADS radius. If the initial energy is less than this, but still bigger than something called the correspondence point, you'll form a 10-dimensional black hole. These five, small five-dimensional black holes, five dimensions smaller than the ADS radius, are unstable to localizing on the 5-sphere. You form a 10-dimensional black hole. Now, what's the limit of size of forming a 10-dimensional black hole? It's just when the black hole becomes of order the string scale. I mean, Joe and I discussed a while ago a correspondence principle where if you take black holes and you make them smaller and smaller, eventually the curvature becomes of order the string scale. All sorts of higher order stringy corrections become important. You can't trust the gravity solution. And the entropy matches that this black hole just becomes a highly excited string state. And so you need to be above that correspondence point in order to form a 10-dimensional black hole. If you're below the correspondence point, but above something sort of of order the string scale energy, you form an excited string. And if you are below that, then this you don't have enough energy to form sort of black holes or strings, so you just get a gas of particles in ADS. And of course, quantum mechanically, the cascade will cut off when the frequency reaches the initial energy. So now what about the dual field theory? Well, the fact that what we're seeing is an evolution to a maximum entropy state can just be viewed as a kind of thermalization. It's not thermalization at fixed temperature, which is what you might usually think about. This is thermalization at fixed energy. So it's a microcanonical ensemble because the classical evolution is done at fixed energy. So from that standpoint, it's not so surprising. But it's extremely universal because it's happening just in the gravity sector, which is a part of any sort of ADS-CFT duality. So this says that any theory with a gravity dual will show this energy cascade like the onset of turbulence. And this actually raises a puzzle because we are working in four-dimensional ADS and the boundary is a 2+1-dimensional field theory. Now, it's well known that in 2+1 dimensions, classical turbulence has an inverse energy cascade. The energy actually starts at small scales and cascades to large scales. And that's related to a conserved vorticity in 2+1 dimensions. I'm told this is responsible for various weather phenomena like hurricanes and things like that, because you just grow the energy on sort of larger and larger scales.
Where you are at the onset of turbulence, can you cross hydro and bomber?
No, but we're not at the sort of, we're talking about the onset of turbulence and the energy cascade. And we clearly show, we see in the bulk evidence that the energy is going to cascade from low to high frequency. So that means. What's that?
Your problem is not having conserved vorticity in 2+1.
The 2+1 dual theory probably does.
Not if you're on a hydro regime. You need a fluid velocity or something to have vorticity. Just talking about waves in the interior of ADS will work with the vorticity.
Well, the velocity is like, the TI components of the metric or something.
You can build a
nonlinear
fluid dynamics at the boundary.
Huh? Could you see
perturbative waves?
Maybe?
Yeah.
Perhaps
that's
your team to kind of
a
black
hole to start with.
The boundary, you still have
to
use one.
You have rotations on it.
There's momentum, but there's nothing that prevents you from having cores to your vortices or.
But there's intuition about turbulence comes from fluid mechanics, right?
Right, it comes from fluids.
But what's happening at the onset of turbulence in the bulk is not the fluid dynamics in the boundary. It's something very different.
After all,
so I trust this.
But why is it that means that there's still the flow of energy from large to small scales?
Yeah, that I agree with, but this intuition is based on fluid mechanics, so it assumes something. And this is not
something that's called that. Oh, the puzzle.
Yeah, exactly.
Since you're spending a lot of time with this analogy, can I ask, is it really a close analogy? I mean, so you described this flow of energy from long scales to short scales in physicist's time.
Right.
And doing your perturbation theory at the next order, you get higher frequencies.
No, it happens in real time.
So yeah, my question is, can you describe how it happens in real time?
Yeah, you start with some perturbation, right, which is say an L equals 2 and L equals 4 mode. And what we see is that the solution includes a term which is an L equals 6 mode with an amplitude growing linearly in T. Now, the solution, if we went to higher order, would include terms of higher order with powers that grew you know, you'd have to then sort of take this linear T piece and back react it. So you'd probably get T squared, or you know, it would sort of come in at later times.
Yeah, wouldn't that happen even just had a linearized instability that had a certain frequency and it was growing already? Isn't it going to source higher frequency? I mean, isn't that what always happens when you have an instability?
If it grows exponentially, you see a plateau just associated with one frequency. You don't see the transference.
Right, ordinary instabilities are e to the plus omega t. Yeah. So there's an exponential growing time.
They saturate, but while they grow, you just see one frequency.
I'd next on an equation when I get e to the 2 omega t.
It saturates. So to speak, it grows too fast, and it saturates before it gets there.
I just mean, if I went to next order in perturbation theory, it looks like I'm going to have an e to the 2 omega t term. Surely, right?
But whenever you see something that is exponential or something, you cannot trust perturbation theory anymore. It saturates. So it grows with the better, and then it saturates.
This is a strong statement. Sorry. You know that you cannot trust perturbation theory.
It's small. No, it's not small.
Yeah.
Okay. So maybe there is an argument along the line Don was making, but it's true that any 2+1 quantum theory with a gravity dual will have this type of behavior. That states at low frequency will cascade, will transfer energy to higher frequency. I think that's just follows from the gravity dual.
You actually think that at the end the energy would redissipate into low frequency modes, right? Because of recurrences.
Because of Poincaré recurrence.
Yeah. So I mean, there's transfer both directions if this is the right one.
Yeah. Okay. So that's finite n. So we, of course, gravity is the infinite n where things don't recur. Okay. So what's the interpretation of the gions in the dual field theory? Of course, the linearized graviton is some spin 2 excitation of your dual theory, something like a spin 2 glue ball. The nonlinear gion is something like a Bose condensate of these excitations. I'm not sure it's exactly a Bose condensate, but you're simply, taking a spin 2 excitation, making amplitude, putting a lot of particles in that. And the important thing is that these high energy states don't thermalize. So if we think about the instability I talked about before as some sort of, not surprising tendency to thermalize, we now have high energy states which are not going to thermalize. There was a recent paper by John and his collaborators in which discussed another class of states which don't thermalize. I've been talking with John a bit about the connection between these two. They're certainly different. One way to see that they're different is that in John's construction, he can't start with ADS and build up these states. He needs to start with something which already breaks conformal symmetry, like a small black hole or a sort of energy eigenstate. Some of these states that they discuss have a simple bulk interpretation. You take a small black hole and you boost it, and it just sort of oscillates in ADS.
You add something to ADS also that you're saying for this gion.
But we can take our gions and make the amplitude arbitrarily small but finite. So we have exact solutions close to ADS which don't thermalize. I mean, I think it's more interesting that we can make the amplitude big, so the energy is even bigger and they don't thermalize. But the fact is that we build this by starting with a perturbation of ADS. Mm-hmm. And John needs to build a state starting with a black hole. Or starting with a...
Does it have to be a black hole? Could it be a particle of arbitrarily small mass just oscillating around the center of ADS? Yeah, I mean, it doesn't...
It's the break conformal thing. His states are claimed by...
Conformal symmetry, but I'm saying, I'm missing the point. Yours can be arbitrarily small in that sense.
But there has to be something that breaks conformal, and then we do something different.
Sorry, the gion breaks conformal symmetry also.
For the gion, they do perturbation theory about ADS. John has to do perturbation theory about not ADS.
Right.
Or not perturbation theory.
Right.
John constructs. I mean, John works mostly in the field theory, and we've worked mostly in the bulk. Okay, so the connection between the two is not totally clear, but it's I mean, it's clear that they're different states that we're constructing.
Well, they're certainly different states.
But, I mean, so some of John's states have the simple bulk interpretation, but there's others that don't. Okay, they're not all just boosted black holes or something. And so it would be nice to know, you know, what's the space? I mean, maybe, I mean, I thought these gions were the only ones that would not thermalize, but now we have some more. And so the question is what...
Discussion just in terms of sort of SL2R generators and so on, and others just exist in the bulk, don't they? I mean, aren't there explicit gravity? I mean, in fact, isn't this discussion sort of description invariant with sort of group theory, right? Is that fair? I mean, could you, I mean...
I don't know how to
Wait, you don't know how to construct them in the bulk?
Yes.
I'll do it. Okay, well, actually, I've already sort of out of time, so I had something else I wanted to tell you about, but maybe I should just skip it, and then and you could say something about your... I don't want to take up... There's more talks today, so let me actually skip... I don't want to skip this. Okay, well, one more comment. This is related again to the boundary CFT description of our gions. Okay, so if you look at the boundary stress tensor, which you can construct, it contains alternating positive and negative energy regions around the equator. Total energy is, of course, positive. But the stress tensor is invariant under the symmetry that the gion is invariant under. And this is a Killing field, which is time-like near the poles of the sphere, but space-like near the equator. So naively, it looks like you have a rotating object, which is rotating faster than light, because on the equator, it's moving faster than the speed of light. But of course, that's not the way to think about this. This is some carefully prepared state, you know, specially prepared and all that way, so that this is like a Christmas tree light effect. Things are just, you know, they're changing, not actual having energy flow faster than light. Okay, so I was going to say something about black holes inside the gion, but maybe we will skip this. Something about super radiance, which I'm going to skip, and then go on to conclusions. Okay, so we've seen that anti-de Sitter spacetime is non-linearly unstable. Generic small perturbations become large and probably form black holes. But for each linearized gravitational load, there's an exact non-linear solution, calling the gion. The dual field theory shows this generic turbulent cascade to maximum entropy state, but there are special states that don't thermalize. A few open questions. Well, we'd like to understand why the energy cascade in 2 plus 1 quantum theory is different from the classical one, and maybe Don has already suggested the answer. We could try to prove a singularity theorem for anti-de Sitter space. I mean, if these arguments are right, then generic asymptotically ADS solutions are singular. So it'd be nice to have a singularity theorem proving that. I'm going to skip this, so that's the thing I didn't talk about. But then there's the question of understanding the space of CFT states that don't thermalize, including gions and these gions. And I'll end there. Thank you.
Your instability is not in fact phase, it's a box, in fact that its resonant frequencies are all multiple of each other.
That's true.
If you took a deformation of ADS, there'd probably be a richer structure maybe with regions of light and plus minus maybe regions of non-ergodic behavior and then, you know, regions or larger regions of ergodic behavior.
You mean change the background? So
change the background,
you know. So it's not, it's, you don't have the energy as if they're not evenly spaced.
Right.
Yeah,
that's right. If they weren't evenly spaced, this wouldn't...
They were deeply spaced, then it'd be some islands where you have nonlinear, quasi gradiated in the forever. It's just like in Buckingham, you see these pictures of phase space with regions of ergodicity and regions of non ergodic behavior. Yeah, it seems like that.
Okay, well,
so, one other question, which is that this picture of focusing is very nice and results from the Nernst simulations are very convincing for this perfectly symmetric case. Of course, this perfectly symmetric case is effectively 1 plus 1 dimensional. And you might think that in a higher dimensional setting, dispersion is more important. So, I mean, what do you think the odds are that the picture changes if you look at, and then to say whether you actually get a black hole at the end for arbitrarily small perturbations, could that change for the Would it be different in the 3+1 case?
What would happen? That the cascade would stop, you say, at some frequency?
No, I don't see a reason why the cascade would stop.
So you keep generating higher and higher frequency modes.
Well, okay.
You're going to get stuck. You keep generating higher and higher.
As long as they're all smaller and smaller amplitudes, you don't have to generate a black hole.
I think the only thing that would change is the time that you take to generate a black hole. It would probably take longer.
So the question is,
it will probably approach more the ergodic time.
Eventually, it will probably get the black hole. Yeah. It will be a much longer time scale.
Oh, yeah. So there's no promise that this will happen quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
As the amplitude gets tuned down, you certainly wait longer and longer to see it. Right. But the end state, classically, I don't see how you can do it.
Just use the words that Joyce said a second ago. You might have thought that the original description of just saying we're in a finite box, without having mentioned the resonant phenomena, you might have thought, well, if they slosh around long enough due to some ergodicity, eventually there'll be some big peak energy density and it'll be a black hole. Mm-hmm. What you actually see, both in your calculations, when you see a resonance, and in the computer simulations, okay, is a much faster collapse towards black holes.
But in our calculation, you cannot say what is the time that it takes to form a black hole. You cannot say that. But for that, you would have to do the full nonlinear transportation to the space.
Okay,
you couldn't do it.
But the fact, well, I agree. You cannot see it from your calculations. So the numerical simulations, they simply much faster. I guess I'm asking whether that quality of the feature could change in higher dimensions, whether for small perturbations it might take a much longer time.
Yeah, I think the fact that you have rotation will make this slow down, so it takes longer to form a black hole.
But
that's just worse. Yeah, that's just worse, I don't know.
Yeah. Or similarly, if you take including things your exact resonance, you might expect it to take a much longer time.
It's still happens. I'm still confused by this box thing. It still happens. You have an infinite number of tries.
Yeah.
You still expect it to happen.
Yeah, okay, good.
Sure, just how long it takes to happen.
You just had a particularly elegant, fast way for it to happen.
I make a comment from the condensed matter side. There's been a small number of studies of universal non-equilibrium properties of these quantum critical slits, and you do seem to get this cascade from low to high energies that you're talking about. For example, yes, non-equilibrium steady state, just the response of the critical, Bose superfluid insulator transition, the response to an electric field. If you think about the formation of that non-equilibrium steady state, you can understand it as a cascade from low to high energies. I mean, I guess on our side, the collapse that you saw is not so surprising because the drive we expect dynamical scaling, and so we expect an energy scale proportional somehow to the drive, which I guess in your sort of quench type picture is the initial amplitude. And this is very interesting. I think it's, and actually I wasn't here for Jill Basim's talk, I think it was last week. He's very interested in similar questions of quenches to black holes, how they might correspond to quenches in atomic condensates to thermal equilibrium. Critical state. I mean, these are very current questions on the condensed matter side as well.
Can you give some reference for these words?
We should talk to you
after. Yeah,
we
should talk to you.
So there have been arguments that you could get the flat space S matrix by considering scattering of normalizable modes in ADS. That's one approach. Mm-hmm. And the counter argument to that is that really you can't isolate one interaction and multiple interactions matter. It seems to me this is really actually strengthening that significantly.
Well, I mean, it's
a reasonable interpretation, but it's not just that you have multiple interactions, but they do even worse things. You have these instabilities.
The S-matrix production just takes place over one period of time to
analyze. Referring to their different approaches. Some people try to get the S-matrix just from pure normalizable
modes.
Just both normalizable states, and the idea is to identify those with CFT states.
And these populations in the Poincaré patch?
No.
Well, people think about it.
I mean, you don't need a time problem. Isn't there still a time? Well, I'm not sure exactly how to count. Well, if you're talking about long time scales, then yes. I agree. This is certainly.
Yeah, you need infinite time scales. And I think this would just, this looks even worse than what's been said before.
Okay. If your wave function is decaying with time because your source is degrading.
No, no, that's not normalized.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I may have misunderstood the question.
So you showed the GI construction first order. Is there an argument that construction continues to all orders?
We showed the GI construction to third order.
I mean, first non-trivial order.
First non-trivial order.
I mean, but is it, do you know that you can do this forever?
Well, we think so. What we can see is for at any even order, there's not any problem because you can't have any resonant modes. At odd order, you can have resonant modes like we saw at third order. But it appears that there'll be just one resonant term in each mode which you can correct by the frequency. So that's evidence. We don't have any proof beyond the third order.
It appears we need one.
Because if you study it, for all, there's always one less resonant mode than what you'd expect. But we cannot give a proof. A proof of that.
Yeah, so in characterizing it as a cascade from low to high, at least the way you presented it, you began with perturbations at some low mode number. So, but if you started with some perturbations at high mode number, would that, are you saying it wouldn't populate the lower mode number ones? It would only populate the higher?
You would have lower modes, but the ones that would grow in time would be the ones with higher frequency.
The lower ones would just oscillate?
Yeah, they would just oscillate. They will be there.
Okay.
Respond to differences in the frequency, for instance. They will give you a smaller frequency. But the one that would grow in time is... Because we also have here modes that have, you know, frequency smaller than the one that you started with.
Right, good. Okay.
But this happens.
This sort of method, having a cascade, you really can't find anything else. There's no way you could see
No, no, we could. Because in fact, when we talked to the generator superposition, there were four resonant terms. So any one of those four could have caused a growing mode. And it turns out only the highest frequency mode actually grows. The rest are all sort of removable. So we could have seen problems with lower modes growing.
Yeah.
That certainly was possible.
Can you tell whether these gluons could exist in a large black hole background?
Yes. Well, those are the slides I have. What do you think? You want to hear something about black holes in the gluon background?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So great. Okay, so let me just go back and say something about the black holes. So okay, so here we are. So first of all, let's talk about small black holes. You have your gluon, and you can put a small black hole at the center of the gluon without destroying the rest of the gluon. The only constraint is that the black hole has to rotate, have to tune the angular velocity in this way, so that the killing field of the gluon, the one symmetric shell you have, actually becomes the Higgs field on the horizon of the black hole. Okay, this is something which we actually haven't constructed in a purely gravity case, but this has been looked at in other contexts where you have gravity coupled to scalars, and you have the boson stars, and people have found, have actually constructed small black holes inside the center of the boson star. And so as a consequence, the current ADS metric is not the only stationary black hole you can have in ADS. You can have these sort of gluon gravitational pair outside it. Okay, so this says you get black holes with only one killing field, which is surprising because most black holes are both stationary and axisymmetric. But this is more relevant to your question. This is the phenomenon of superradiance. So if you have a wave scattering off of a rotating black hole and the frequency is less than n times the angular velocity of the black hole, you can return with larger amplitude. That's called superradiance. In ADS, the outgoing wave is reflected and it comes back and it scatters again with larger amplitude, and you get a superradiant instability. So this is another instability, not the turbulent one. This is an instability just for rotating black holes in ADS if they satisfy this condition. So what's the endpoint? If you perturb your black hole with just a single mode, this mode will grow, and it will settle down to something which looks like a black hole inside a gion. That's the expected end state. But now suppose you perturb your black hole with a superposition of modes. The super radiance is going to cause those modes to grow, but then the turbulent instability will source the higher frequency modes. And so what happens? That's the question. And the short answer is we don't know. There are a couple of possibilities. If the black hole starts absorbing these higher frequency modes faster than they can be created, you might end up with a black hole with gravitational waves washing around outside the horizon. So this is a situation with no symmetries. The gravitational waves bounce off infinity but can't be absorbed because you're sort of in the super radiant regime. And so you just get some non-symmetric stuff around your black hole. On the other hand, the black hole might continue to evolve. The exterior might continue to evolve with these, you know, higher and higher frequency modes generated. And then who knows what the lifetime behavior is. So
this is a large black hole, or?
Okay, so a large black hole can still be super radiantly unstable for large N modes.
Yeah.
That's right. So a large black hole in ADS is unstable only if you have a very large M and as a neutral quantum number. And then you have the same question. Okay, if you perturb it with one of those modes, you probably get some large M geon.
You need it to be rotating?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, the black hole must rotate or else you don't have this instability. Oh, you can't put a black hole inside a geon unless it's rotating, because otherwise you don't have a killing horizon.
When you talk about putting a black hole inside the geon, it has to be a small black hole, and then you're saying it can grow, the black hole can grow?
You can look at this in these simpler cases where you have scalar fields coupled to gravity, and we've sort of explored precisely what the space of black holes with scalar hair is outside, and there's a region, in that case, for a given mode, geon, the black hole can be up to a certain size. And then if you make it bigger, it swallows up the whole geon and you have nothing left. Okay, so there's always an upper bound for a given mode, but if you pick your black hole first, you can find a high enough M so that the geon will exist outside.
Can I just make a comment? I mean, in the case that black holes are large, we have thermodynamic description. So this case, the turbulence outside might have something to do with an average toxic equations turbulence.